So what do? We just kick it off or does somebody...
I think you say who you are and I'll say who I am. Yeah.
Should I just start?
Yeah, go on.
Okay.
Go
for it. Well, hello everybody. I'm Robert Peston. I made the mistake of coming in a bit earlier and listening to that conversation, which took me so far out of my comfort zone, I was about to run away. But I'll tell you one thing which I was struck by, which is you said that what you like about maths is its certainty. And actually, it's one of the things I don't like about maths, because I really like uncertainty. I mean, I loved maths when I was at school because I wasn't too bad at it. And, you know, it was one of those subjects where you just knew, if you knew the formula, you could get 100% and it was an easy O level or an easy A level. But it didn't really get me going. And what I like is the uncertainty of life.
Well, okay, I agree with you. And I think that one of the important things to really highlight is that mathematics is full of unsolved problems that we don't know how to solve. And that's what makes it a living subject. If we knew everything, it would be boring. And so I think that... I find appealing those problems. I'm drawn to those problems which I don't understand yet. But ultimately, what I still will come back to the fact that I love the fact that there will be an answer and I'll know when I've got it.
But I quite like problems where you're absolutely confident there are no answers, and I think there are some of those in life. And the other thing that worries me about maths is the way that it is consistently misapplied. I mean, Bonnie was talking about the banking crisis, and one of the things that went, one of the contributors to the banking crisis was that bankers took false comfort from what they perceived as the certainty of their formulae for calculating risk. And what they failed to notice was, although the formulae were elegant, if you put crap into a formula, you'll get crap out the other end. And that's broadly what happened.
Do you think that's true? My impression is actually that there was such incentivization to... such incentives to take risks that the maths was telling you really you shouldn't do.
No, no.
That that's
absolutely not. Quite the reverse. I mean, in the sense that all these banks built these highly elaborate models for measuring risk, and these were models that were approved by the regulators. Indeed, the regulators used them themselves for evaluating whether or not these big institutions were taking the right kind of risks or excessive risks. Now, of course, I would agree with you that there was a degree of wishful thinking around the place. People saw the opportunities to make tons of money, and that, to a certain extent, abolished common sense quite a lot of the time. But underpinning the system that went so spectacularly wrong were these immensely complicated models which told the banks that they weren't in fact taking very great risks, when the reality was that they were taking enormous risks. I'll give you an example of one of the things that went wrong, for example. The models would look at what happened to the price of shares or securities over the previous few years. And on the basis of how those shares or securities or loans had performed over the previous period, they would extrapolate from what happened in the past to what was likely to happen in the future. And you got... Now, this is the misapplication of maths. This is not... I'm not remotely saying that, you know, all mathematicians are evil. It's just the people who use them are occasionally evil. What happened was, you all know that from 92 to 97, we had this extraordinary, unprecedented period of unbroken growth, of extraordinary prosperity in the West. We hadn't known a period of that kind of steady, unbroken growth in this country, well, arguably ever, possibly, I mean, certainly before records began, maybe in the 19th century, there might have been one or two periods, but nothing quite. I mean, this was extraordinary. 15 years, not a single three-month period of negative, of the economy contracting. And the problem with that, when you're trying to calculate risk, if you're a financial institution, is the longer that it goes on, the more data you have that says this is how securities behave or the economy behaves, and you feed all that into your model, and it tells you that actually the world is becoming a less risky place, whereas in fact common sense would tell you...
I think that that's a misrepresentation of what mathematics says, because that's not what mathematics will do with that data.
But it's what these models did with the data.
I think, because it will be a bad model, because that's like saying if I get six... You know, the whole point about the financial system, it is a probabilistic system, and that's why... I mean, there's some
determinism... But it's only as good as the data you put in, surely.
Yeah, and that's. But you've got to remember that when there are independent data, and so, you know, if I flip a coin 100 times and I've got 100 heads in a row, well, okay, one thing you could say, I think that coin is biased and therefore I will always bet on heads, which might be one good way to interpret that data. Or the other one is, my God, that's an incredibly lucky sample, but the probability that it's going to land heads next time is still 50-50, and I must ignore the data. So I think there's a real balance in how you analyse. I mean, it's true, you know, why shouldn't, if we see a pattern that there's a huge, we seem to have got it right, maybe, everything's sort of...
That's what people thought.
I know, exactly. And I think that mathematicians are more aware that you have to look at the data and analyse whether this is...
As I say, it was the application that went wrong. I mean, for me, the moment of sort of, I suppose, revelation about the extent to which these models were misapplied. August 2007, markets freeze. And in particular, a particular way of raising money, which is parcelling up mortgages and selling them to investors, that market completely shut down. It was a market worth hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. The chap, one of the brightest bankers in the world, chap was the finance director of probably the most successful investment bank in the world, Goldman Sachs, gives a quote to the... Financial Times about, on the basis of Goldman, and this is an incredibly sophisticated investment bank, they said on the basis of their own risk models, this event was supposed to have a probability of occurring not once in the lifetime of the universe, but once in the lifetime of the universe to the power of, you know, however many universes you can sort of calculate. I mean, it was one of those events that should never, ever, 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 ever have happened. And of course, it did happen. Which, and what it told you was, the model was just bonkers. But it was a highly complicated. And also, all I'm saying really about all of this is people took, it seems to me, false comfort from the sophistication.
No, I think that's true. And the interesting thing is that what they want from mathematicians quite often is that comfort. I mean, I found myself asking that they want definite answers, and very often we can't. We have to say, and science is about that. I don't know, and I think that's true with a lot of sort of things where science impacts on society. That we want a definite answer whether climate change is happening. Well, there's a lot of evidence that it is happening, but you ask a scientist and they will equivocate a little bit, because that they can't. There isn't a certainty about, you know, the data seems to be really sending us off to something pretty bad. But I think it's interesting how politicians and sort of want certainty from scientists, which we cannot give them. Do you think that hedge funds are evil?
No, not at all. Actually, I mean, I think that, like, there are spivs everywhere. I mean, there are spivvy hedge funds, there are spivvy bankers, you know.
But it seems
there
to be
are spivvy
a lot
journalists.
Of...
I think, what I think, I've got two views about hedge funds. One was, for me, it was the returns that hedge funds, this is one of those sort of common sense things, the returns that hedge funds were making in 2005 to 2007 was what said to me, we're heading for a crash. You know, there were individual hedge fund managers who were, a chap called Jamie Simon, he's actually, you know, you may have heard of
Jim
him.
Jim Simons. Yeah. I mean, he's a fantastic mathematician.
Brilliant mathematician, right?
He's coming to give a talk in Oxford in the geometry seminar about his maths, nothing to do with the finance. So, yeah.
But he runs one of the world's most successful hedge funds. It's called Renaissance. And he, in a single year, actually for many of the recent single years, he's been taking out more than $1 billion personally as income, right? And he's not alone. There have been other, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being taken out by individuals in this industry, and returns in terms of the capital they deploy, just in the stratosphere. I mean, hundreds, thousands of percent returns. Now, when people make returns of that sort, what it says to me is that markets aren't working efficiently, Because if markets are working efficiently, then as soon as you get that kind of return, you get competition into the market, and those returns are immediately competed away. And if people are making those sorts of returns, it may be because people are somehow being gulled by the complication of the particular products that are being created, so that people can't see the risks. It may be that in many cases what happened actually was something very, very simple, that debt for certain groups of individuals who were playing in the markets became so cheap at a time when there was this irrational exuberance and everything was going up. It was actually an incredibly easy way to make money and had nothing to do with the sophisticated mathematics that
Funds is probably where some of the most sophisticated maths is happening.
But what I'm saying is that although some of the returns, and Jamie Simon may well be one of those people who is actually not doing something simple and disguising it as complicated. Quite a lot of hedge funds, and indeed other players in the market, like private equity players, were pretending to do something incredibly complicated, but actually doing something very simple, which was to borrow money cheaply to buy an asset that was rising. And the best way of explaining what happened in this case is to think about the difference. This is very, very simple. It explains both why we had this great boom and why we've had this great bust. Much of what happened during the boom was that people borrowed money in the way that we buy houses, right? You buy a house. This is obviously blindingly obvious to you. But you buy a house for £100,000. If you spend £100,000 of your own money, and it goes up to £110,000, you've made a return of 10%. If you borrow £90,000 from the bank, only £10,000 of your own money goes up to £110,000. You've turned £10,000 into £20,000. You've made 100% return. Now, much of that bubble was simply hedge funds, private equity, banks borrowing to buy assets and then selling the assets before they fell. And now the problem with the availability of cheap debt that drives a bubble in that sense is that when it goes into reverse, the maths operates in the opposite direction in an immensely painful way, so that if you buy a house for £100,000 and you borrow £90,000 and it then goes to £80,000, your entire investment has been wiped out. And of course, In a downturn, which is what we've been living through over the past couple of years, it was that negative, all that equity that people had who hadn't got out of the market just got wiped out. And a lot of what the hedge funds, the bad hedge funds, did nothing more sophisticated than that. And that's why the bad hedge funds have been wiped out. Now, a lot of hedge funds are still around.
Renaissance, of course, made money during this last year. Extraordinary.
And there are clever hedge funds. I think the only really positive thing that I can say about the hedge funds is this, which is that many of them did spot and indeed warn that there was a bubble here, and politicians, regulators ignored them. One of the reasons some of them made money was because they saw a crash coming and they bet against it. Now they become vilified because people think that in some senses they're profiting from people's misery. I understand why people think that what they do is sort of somehow evil and wrong. And actually, I am one of those people who doesn't understand individuals are only motivated by money. It just is so way out of my own sort of sense of what motivates me that I don't completely understand the psychology of these people. But I don't think that as a class they are evil. No.
I think it's interesting because when I go into a hedge fund, it actually feels they're quite relaxed places. They feel a bit like maths departments where people are just playing these games in a way. I mean, I don't think they are motivated by money, a lot of them. What they enjoy is just playing the game and seeing whether they can spot the inefficiencies, which I think is what it's often about, and exploit those.
Well, money's the score for them.
It's the score.
It's not so much that they, once you've got 14 Lamborghinis, I suppose that's enough. But I mean, they are still obsessed with making more and more money because, for them, that is the score. That's how they measure themselves.
Yeah. There was an interesting proposal in the last conversation we had that there should be mathematicians in government. I mean, do you think Do you think that MPs should understand more mathematics than they do to be able to... I mean, if you're running the economy, surely you need to understand maths, don't you? I mean, or not?
I think that in general, it would help if people had a greater understanding of risk and probability, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, there is... and this is true of politicians, it's true of the media, I think it's true of many of us, I mean, you know, you see it in the coverage of, you know, the likelihood of, you know, flu killing people, or, you know, people always focus on, you know, the worst case, not the most likely outcome, as it were. And so I think there is a sense in which I would like to see people...
Yeah, I mean, we are very bad at that, aren't we?
Assessing unbelievably bad.
Risk. I mean, that's interesting. There's a professor for the public understanding of risk in Cambridge, which is funded by Winton Capital, a hedge fund. Because they, you know, they...
That's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, they believe that it's a real problem. We just don't... I think the other thing is, which was illustrated by a lot of the discussion over the crash, is that people are very bad at understanding big numbers. So when you talk about billion, trillion, I mean, it's beyond a million. It's all kind of like infinity, I think, for most people. It's, you know, like, it's quite hard to assess.
Well, these numbers are extraordinary. The amount of taxpayers' money that has gone into propping up the banking system across the world is $15 trillion. That's a quarter of everything the world produces in a single year. I mean, we've never, ever, ever committed that kind of money to propping up banks. It's just over $2,000 per person on the planet, which is, I suppose, the way that I try and break it down into a number that is easier for people to grasp. But I think, well, actually, for most people, once you're much beyond a million, actually, you just think that sounds like a big number. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So, and that, of course, produces real problems, because I think in court cases, for example, if you say, there's a one in a million chance that their DNA matches that of the one. You know, people think, oh, that's certain, isn't it? But actually, you know, in a town like London, there are 10 million people here. So that means there are 10 people whose DNA might match that. And therefore, why are you picking this one out of the 10?
Funny enough, I got into I won't name it, but a particular... Yeah. I read a column years ago making that point, and a particular individual... took it unbelievably personally and hates me since, because actually, you're right, people do rather misunderstand these things. It's
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's why something like the long player...
It's about paternity. I won't go any further.
Yeah, well, there was the case of the woman who was put in jail for two cot deaths that happened, and that was a misapplication of probability. Yeah. That put, you know... a 1 in 72 million chance that she would have had two children. For a start, they multiplied the probabilities, and if there is something genetic, then that's, you can't multiply probabilities for two events because they're dependent. Also, the chance that a mother kills their two children, well, that's also incredibly rare. So the mathematics was totally misapplied by prosecution and the judge, who didn't pick up. And you know, it was a mistrial because of a misunderstanding of mathematics.
Scary, isn't it?
It is scary, because, you know, it isn't just an abstract, pure game that, I mean, that's what I do in my office, but, you know, actually it has implications.
I mean, the other thing which is similar, I suppose, to that problem is that the people who were on the boards of these banks didn't understand the maths at all, and they were totally reliant on people below them to mm-hmm. advise them about what was going on lower down. The other sort of moment of revelation for me was actually quite a long time before the crash. I did a little thing for the Today programme where I tried to... Well, I decided that the British people needed to know what a collateralised debt obligation was and a credit default swap, which are these rather complicated products that were dreamed up by bankers to basically gull the world and make themselves a lot of money, and they don't have any social use whatsoever. We weren't absolutely certain about at the time, and I went to a number of investment banks and said to individual bankers who were creating these things, I said, you know, please explain this to in a way that, you know, 4 million Today program listeners can understand. And I was in Morgan Stanley, one of the world's biggest investment banks, and it was enormous trading floor, probably a trading floor as big as the surface area of the Roundhouse. Extraordinary screens everywhere, and all this guy did was these collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. And I said to him, you know, please, please explain this in a way that your grandmother could understand. And 10 minutes later, sweat dripping from him, absolutely clear to me that his grandmother could understand this if she happened to be a hedge fund manager. But frankly, nobody else in the world possibly could. And actually, I'm one of those people who believes in life that if an individual can't explain what they do, chances are they don't know what they're really doing, certainly in terms of the risks they're running.
I think that's true. I think that applies also to why I think more scientists should spend time doing sort of public understanding of science issues. Because I got into this game a few years ago writing some articles for the Times, but actually it has benefited my mathematics because it's challenged me to, do I really understand what I'm doing, or am I making assumptions? If I have to explain to somebody who doesn't have the technical background and assumptions that I've probably am working under, it really tests my understanding of things. So I think there's a real place for really forcing people to go on the Today programme and explain what the Poincaré conjecture is or whatever those things that you just said was.
Collateralize that obligation. Yeah. Do you think, I mean, you're a bit younger than me, but we're a roughly similar generation. Do you think that, I mean, I think there was more of an attempt by the mass media and the BBC and TV to try and communicate things like, you know, mathematical issues and science to kids. Do you have all the opportunities you would like to, in a sense, reach out to a wider audience?
I think it's quite a good climate at the moment. And things like, I think there's an appetite out there still for it, amongst adults and who want to, and children as well, but I mean mostly adults who really want to understand some of these interesting ideas. So I think I've made a program for Horizon just recently, all about fractals and chaos theory, and I think it's the BBC know that there's a market out there for it. And I think I've had this column in the Times about maths last year, and they were quite surprised at how long we kept it going, because they thought, oh, well, there won't be an interest for it.
And there was a lot of feedback, was there?
There was a lot of feedback, and that's why they said, oh, you know, actually, and I'm just starting a new column next week, which is sort of more broad science. But I think that science is, people have got an appetite for it. So I don't think, Horizon has changed. I think Horizon in the past really preached to the converted, for example. I think that's why when we were younger, it was hardcore and we loved it, or at least I loved it. And I think now Horizon has changed. It's trying to, and I think that's a brave thing that it's doing, and it's getting a lot of flack for it, but it's trying to get new audiences interested in science who wouldn't usually come to it. That's why this program that I've been making, it's been a journey that I've made with Alan Davis, the comedian. Okay, so why do you need a comedian to help explain science? But actually, he plays a good role, because he plays the role of the viewer and can ask the silly questions that probably weren't asked before. So I think actually it's quite an exciting time. BBC Four, for example, I think can make experiments and do things. This series I did on the history of mathematics, I don't think you could have done that 20 years ago, but there's a space where BBC Four can experiment, find actually that there is an appetite for it, and then move it. You know, it's been on BBC World. Hopefully it'll come to BBC Two as well. So I think actually it's a really exciting time to be in trying to communicate the excitement of science to the general audience.
And are there more or enough yet kids again wanting to be scientists and mathematicians?
Because
for years we went through a bit of a drought, but...
There have been good signs this year that a lot more people have taken maths and further maths, for example, at A level. So that sort of seems to be on the up. But we've got tough competition. You know, there are many more subjects at university that people can take, vocational courses, media studies, things like this.
Big waste of time.
Exactly. Yeah. But and mathematics is a tough subject, so we've still got to work hard to excite people about why they should do it. But, I think if you go into a job interview for whatever you're going to do and you say you've done a maths degree, you get immediate respect for it because of it's saying something about the way your mind works, I think. So, I still think we have to work hard because, and it's part of our responsibility. I became a mathematician because of a teacher who made the effort to bring it alive for me. So I sort of feel I owe it to my subject to try and encourage the next generation. That's why I did things like the Christmas lectures. I went to the Christmas lectures when they were first done on maths in 1978. And I came away saying, I want to be him when I grow up, as Christopher Zeman did it. And it was really exciting to have the chance to do the same for kids now. And I think we've still got a problem, though, with the curriculum a little bit. I mean, the curriculum for maths is unexciting especially in Key Stage 3, kids are just getting bored by it. And I think we need to be a bit braver about what we challenge our students with. Same with the science as well. I think, you know, we shouldn't be frightened to show them really tough ideas. I think kids like that.
Yeah. And when you're going into the hedge funds, which turns out I don't think are evil, what are you doing there?
I'm trying to persuade them to give money to mathematics, actually.
Oh, right.
Most of the time.
And do they?
Yes. Jim Simons, for example, realises that he owes mathematics a lot for where he's got to. So he's made fantastic contributions to projects. He funded a new lecture theatre at the Maths and Sciences Research Institute in Berkeley.
Yeah, this is America. I was more wondering here.
Yeah, so, Yeah, he's coming to give a seminar in the geometry seminar in Oxford. And it's got nothing to do with the fact that we're hoping to build a new maths building down the road. But I think, you know, he is positive and he wants to give things back. Also, something like the Millennium Problems. You might have heard about these. These are seven maths problems that we can't solve, which Landon Clay, who made a lot of money using his maths, he's very excited by maths. He said, I want to give something back. He says, I'm going to give $1 million for anybody who can solve one of these problems. And that's, you know, it's a publicity stunt. We don't do it for the money. I mean, I'll pay somebody $1 million to solve the Riemann hypothesis, but it's good publicity. So actually, one of them has been proved a couple of years ago, the Poincaré conjecture by a Russian mathematician. And, you know, that prize meant I was actually in Guatemala at the time, and I was watching Fox News, and up came this banner along the bottom, you know, Poincaré conjecture proved. I mean, on the Fox News, you know. So he did really a lot of good, because nobody would have talked about the Poincaré conjecture before that $1 million prize, which Landon Clay gave. And I think we do need help. And I think hedge funds, a lot of them have made their money out of mathematics and they want to give something back to the community.
But aren't too many bright people, particularly scientists and mathematicians, being sucked into hedge funds when, frankly, they could be doing rather more?
Yeah, I think it is a tragedy. I lost a very good postdoc who joined Deutsche Bank. Because he, I mean, there's exciting maths in these banks, so it's not. He's still being quite stimulated, but I mean, I think he may regret it, because I think there's more to life than money. I mean, for me, I value the time that I have to think much more than I do the money that I would earn. You know, most of my students, they go off and earn instantly more than I am in the jobs that they do, because mathematics does give you a lot of power to earn things. But
I mean, one of the paradoxes, I'd be interested to know what you think about this, one of the paradoxes about much of the innovation in banking and markets is that a lot of the development of these newfangled products I've been talking about have been designed to reduce risk, right? I mean, obviously people have criticised institutions that knowingly took crazy risky bets, but actually much of what happened over the past 10, 15 years, which in the end created enormous instability, was development of products and services whose point was allegedly to reduce risk. It was to, for example, help companies, in a simple case, if they're based in Britain, but they sell a lot of stuff for which they get dollars, it was to, you know, allow them to have more certainty about what sterling they would receive over the coming months and years as they sold their stuff in dollars. It was, you know, it's called hedging. It's essentially for in that particular instance, just a way of giving a company a bit more certainty about what income is coming in. And there's been a spectacular amount of this kind of innovation. So, for example, one of the most controversial products, which are these credit default swaps, initially started as I think a sort of perfectly sort of with a perfectly sensible idea, which is as a form of insurance against a loan going bad, against the idea that the person that you've lent to or the institution you've lent to won't repay you. So they're broadly, you know, a bit like insuring against, you know, flooding your house or something. It's just, you know, insurance against a loan going bad. Now they turned into actually just a way of speculating in the fortunes of the company. All sorts of people bought these so-called credit default swaps, not as insurance, but just because they were traded on the market, price went up and down, and it was an alternative to buying shares to speculate in a company. And there was a moment when there was something like notional value, $70 trillion of this stuff out there, more than the value of everything the world produces, and most of that was just speculative. But the interesting point about, and I'm interested to know whether you can, whether you sort of ever thought about, you know, this in terms of your own work, is the interesting point about this hedging is it's now thought that the effect of this hedging in the round has been to create instability rather than stability. That for every sort of product that was supposed to be reducing the instability in a particular area, it actually created an incentive for somebody else to produce a product that would then insure against that product, that would then hedge against that product. And at the end of the day, you actually created a world that was intrinsically much less stable. Does that make sense to you at all?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the sort of mathematics I do isn't financial mathematics. I'm talking not from a position of strength, but I think it's probably true that in some ways what the hedge funds are doing is almost looking at the system, but they are part of the system. So you get this sort of tower on tower on tower that you now have to do a sort of they're probably hedge of hedge funds in a sense, you know. So I can believe that that hasn't been factored into the way the system works and maybe is now being done. So,
well, I mean, I suppose for me, you see, what it comes back to is this idea that maybe we just need to have rather simpler world in which there's rather less speculation, as it were, or rather less hedging in this particular case. It's not an in terms of sort of policy making, not an unimportant subject, but unfortunately there is so much money made out of these products, and particularly in America, the ability of the institutions to lobby in Congress means that actually the potential for conceivably the right kind of reforms gets rather reduced, just because particularly if you're in the Senate or the House of Representatives, you're getting so much in the way of campaign contributions from many of these institutions that telling them that actually Christmas has arrived and they're the turkeys isn't easy. But,
do you think that there's enough investment in science in England, in the UK? I mean, Gordon Brown did come to Oxford and sort of bigged up the how, you know, science will be an important part of the future of the economy. But it does seem like we've been built on shadows so far, service industries and things like that, and actually sort of our scientific base, our industrial base, which was based on the science that we were very good at, has disappeared. But, you know, there's a lot of great science happening in universities. Do you think there's enough sort of communication going on to realize that gain?
No, I'm sure there isn't. I mean, one of the things we learned in the last few years is not that services are intrinsically bad. I mean, they do generate real earnings domestically and overseas. It's not the notion that something has to be something you can hold in your hand to give real economic value is plainly not right. Services are of real value, but we became too dependent on a particular form of services, financial services. We put too many eggs in that particular basket. So I very passionately believe that we have to have a more broadly based economy, a more diversified economy, and of course, part of that would be the application of better application in the commercial sense of so much of the science that is going on. And we are crap compared to the States in taking the brilliant work that's done in universities and then translating it into, goods and services that can then benefit the UK. I mean, it is no coincidence that all the great IT companies, with very few exceptions, we've got one or two decent ones over here, but, Google, Microsoft, they're all American companies, and it's a lot of it is just to do with not only the brilliance of their universities, and they have got great universities, but it's also about the extent to which the individuals with, actually some of the scientists themselves, but just the culture of those institutions is much more about commercialising. And I mean, do you, I mean, it's fascinating to me to watch academics being tortured by whether or not they're in a sense selling out when they think in a when they think about the sort of commercialization.
I mean, what do you feel about that yourself? No, it's true.
Way?
I think there is a climate of this ivory tower, which I think it is breaking down, and I think that there's more encouragement to think about how your science can relate to what industry are doing, and more collaborations. We have in Oxford, as part of the maths department, where industry comes in with the problems that they have, and we try and see whether we can solve them. So I think there's more communication going on. But I still think there is a cultural barrier, almost, to the fact that we could be doing so much more. And I think government, industry, education, and universities need to communicate more.